The House Judiciary Session is convened. We have a quorum to do business. In attendance are Representative Grunberg, Representative Coghill, Representative Ramirez, Representative Lynn. Before us is House Bill 36. We were in the process of amendment number... Sorry? Pardon me? We had before us House Bill 36. We were working on amendment number 3. Who had amendment number 3?
I did. Mr. Chairman, I'll withdraw amendment number 3.
Amendment number 3 has been withdrawn. Susan? Representative Coghill?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move amendment number 4, which is labeled E.8, dated 4/14/09.
E.8. We have online to assist us Chris Ellingson with APOC.
Online.
Thank you, Chris. We appreciate you staying with us. We'll try and take care of this as expediently as is wise. We've been joined by Representative Holmes. We also have Jason Hooley here to answer questions. Representative Coghill, the floor is yours. Amendment number 4 has been moved. Is there an objection?
Mr. Chair, that's the E8.
E.8.
I'd like to have Mr. Hooley come forward with, if he has the language that I had requested.
Amendment number 4 has been moved. Is there an objection?
Yes.
Representative Grunberg objects to amendment number 4 for the purposes of discussion.
And I would, if I could, Mr. Hooley, what language should we put in based on your research? As a result of what I suggested last time.
Question was, what language should be put forward as a result of
your research?
Yeah, well, you were going to suggest language to me put in here.
This is Jason Hooley, Office of Lieutenant Governor Sean Parnell. Representative Grunberg, through the chair, I'm just going to make sure I'm remembering your question as to the timing of the public hearings.
Mm-hmm.
If your desire is for them to be conducted after the signature gathering phase, the proper language is after the petition has been properly filed.
Okay. I will probably offer that instead of the 30 days before the election. After the petition has been properly filed. That will give the Lieutenant Governor then enough time to hold the hearings.
And Mr. Chairman.
Representative Coghill, then the bill sponsor.
Yeah, I just wanted to make sure for those listening in, this amendment says at least 30 days before the election, the Lieutenant Governor or their designee will hold 2 public hearings concerning the initiative. So this allows the discretion as to when they may start, but it makes sure that they have to do it at a certain time before the election to make sure it does happen. So I'll defer to the sponsor from there.
May I just one thing?
Representative Grunberg.
May I dialogue with Representative Coghill for a second?
Can we hear from the prime sponsor first?
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In conversations with the Lieutenant Governor,
you just reintroduce yourself. Oh,
I'm
just
sorry,
for the record.
Kyle. Yeah, I'm sorry, Kyle Johansson, Representative for House District 1. And Mr. Hooley obviously can speak for the Lieutenant Governor's office. But in my conversations with Lieutenant Governor and also with Mr. Hooley, the intent was to begin, as Representative Grunberg said, when the petition is approved, or the language that Mr. Hooley talked about. The Lieutenant Governor would like to have a specific time frame in the 30 days prior to the election would give you a start date of when he puts it on the ballot and an end date.
Okay.
So there's a window where these meetings can be held, but far enough away from the election that you're done and there's time prior to the election.
Is that okay with
you? I think that's...
With that, Mr. Chair.
Representative Rimber.
If we were to then say on Amendment 8, no earlier than...
On E.8, Amendment Number 4.
Thank you.
Yes.
Yeah. Sorry. If we were to say something like, no earlier than the date the petition has been properly filed, and then we go at least 30 days, that would give him the window. Would that be agreeable to... I'll ask Representative Johansson, and I would ask Lieutenant Governor's staff if that would be acceptable.
Let me recognize that Representative Dahlstrom has joined us. Also, Representative Millett is in the room with us.
Could I, Mr. Chair, ask if that's okay with Representative Johansson and with the Lieutenant Governor?
Would you restate that, Representative Rimber?
Mm-hmm. On line 3 of the amendment, It would say no earlier than the date the petition has been properly filed, or you could say the day after, whatever, and at least 30 days before the election. So we would have that window. Would that be acceptable?
Mr. Chair, I think we all have the same concept, the specific language. I think Mr. Hooley could probably help you with. Mm-hmm. I think we're all on the same page, Mr. Chairman. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chairman, Jason Hooley again. The language in the on line 4, which states an initiative is to appear on the ballot, implies that we have found that petition to be properly filed.
Mm-hmm.
We would not have considered it to be appearing on a ballot if it has not been properly filed. Your suggestion makes it more explicit, but I believe it's implied in this section.
Mr. Chair, may I ask a question?
Representative Groomer.
Yeah, I'm trying to put a start date. And the start date would be, oh, I see what you're saying. So you could say, I think you have to say, I can just say conceptually, what I want it to be is the start date would be the date that the Lieutenant Governor certifies that it has been properly filed. And then the end date would be 30 days before the election. And that's my conceptual amendment.
Thank you. But and at the appropriate time, we will let you offer an amendment to the amendment. The concern of the chair is that we have now 8 meetings to schedule, 2 in 4 different judicial districts. And as is the case, whether it's a municipal election or a state election, voters don't engage generally until a window of time before an election cycle. In this case, if I understand the way this amendment is constructed and is presently acceptable to the sponsor and the Lieutenant Governor's office, the 8th meeting has to happen.
Yeah.
Thank you. Has to happen at least 30 days before the election. So if the election was on August 22nd, the 8th meeting would have to happen at least by July 22nd or 23rd.
Whatever.
And then the 8th, 7th, 6th, mm-hmm. 5th, 4th, 3rd, 2nd, and 1st meeting would happen prior to that. But we would leave some latitude to the Lieutenant Governor to schedule those meetings. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
All right. And what are the wishes of the prime sponsor? Do you prefer that the latitude be given to whoever the Lieutenant Governor is, or would you prefer to have a more specific interpretation of when is the start date? And then we all agree, I think there's consensus around the table that this is the end date for the 8th meeting.
Mr. Chairman, I believe the analysis by the Lieutenant Governor's office that on line 4, if it appears on the ballot at some point, the Lieutenant Governor signed off on it, and I think that's perfectly clear.
Okay.
And giving leeway to the Lieutenant Governor, I think, is the proper thing to do so they can manage the process according to their resources and time, et cetera.
Thank you. So we appreciate the clarification from the prime sponsor. Do you wish to offer the conceptual amendment?
Let me just ask. So you're suggesting there not be a start date?
Through the chair, agreeing with the Lieutenant Governor's office in line four, as it says, it appears on the ballot, there is a specific day when the Lieutenant Governor approves something to go on the ballot. And when he signs his signature, that is the start date. And the end date is 30 days prior to the...
So it would have to be, it's by its various terms. I see. I don't need to offer it then.
And if I just may further clarify, you have to have the signatures turned in before the gavel goes down. So if the gavel goes down January 20th, you have to have the signatures in prior to the 20th. And the earliest that it could be is the primary election, which would be August 20th. So the 8th meeting would have to be concluded by July 20th. Mm-hmm. And the 1st through the 8th meeting could happen anytime between January 20th and July 20th, as it's presently drafted.
May I just ask a follow-up question?
Certainly, Representative.
Mr. Hooley, the way it's currently drafted, are you quite sure that any successor lieutenant governor would know they couldn't start the hearings before they certified it? Would that be crystal clear to any administration administering this?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, I believe that the statute is sufficiently clear to provide all lieutenant governors with that window of post proper filing and prior to 30 days.
I understand. Okay, I want to offer. That's fine.
Are you okay?
Yeah, if I objected, I'll withdraw my objection.
Okay, so Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Switching topics and looking down onto the sentence on line 6 and 7, it says that each public hearing under this section shall include the testimony of one supporter and one opponent of the initiative. I guess I have a couple of questions about that. Does this require people other than the Lieutenant Governor's office to fly or drive or get themselves one way or another to each one of those 8 meetings?
Through the chair, the intent is to have the public hearing, whether they fly there or drive there or walk there or call in on teleconference, the intent is to have, much like the election pamphlet, the opportunity for those supporting an initiative and those opposing an initiative to talk about what is in the initiative. And simply the Lieutenant Governor providing the forum, if a supporter or an opponent, I would imagine in the real world, if you have an issue that is on the ballot that has the support of the signatures to get on the ballot, I think you could probably find one person in each meeting for each of the judicial districts to present the idea to the public. If not, then I guess it doesn't mean that much to the people who are pushing the issue. So,
Representative Holmes?
Follow up, Mr. Chairman, and I do concede that in most cases that's probably correct. The problem is by using the word shall, I'm afraid that if you say you have a ballot initiative that everybody loves, there really isn't much opposition to, you're still going to be required to hold these. What if there's nobody who shows up? Then is the whole meeting invalid because you don't act, because we said you shall, you have to include testimony from both sides. If only one side shows up and nobody shows up from the other side, have we invalidated the meeting, and does the Lieutenant Governor have to keep holding meetings until they find somebody who shows up to speak on both sides? That's kind of the
through the chair, it's not the intent to invalidate any of these public meetings. If Lieutenant Governor's office may have a different perspective, but I suppose the way it is written in the election pamphlet, if someone decides not to have input on a pro or con, then I guess that's their problem. So I don't see a problem with putting may. I mean, if they choose not to, then that's their problem. Maybe the Lieutenant Governor has a different...
And I would point out that the testimony is an undefined term, so there could be a letter. Mm-hmm. There would be satisfactory for testimony. Mm-hmm. Mr. Hooley?
Mr. Chairman, to date, every time there's been an initiative on the ballot, the official election pamphlet produced by the Division of Elections gathers statements of support and opposition, and we would use that as a starting point as we hold these hearings.
Representative Holmes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just wondering, just to make sure that it's clear, I'm considering, and I wanted the sponsor and the Lieutenant Governor's input on whether it would be okay if we said something along the lines of each public hearing under this section shall allow opportunity for the testimony of at least one supporter and one opponent of the initiative, something like that, so that it's clear that it's the meeting isn't invalid, so that both sides are at least allowed the opportunity. If nobody shows up, nobody puts anything forward, it doesn't invalidate the meeting.
Any comments on a conceptual amendment of that nature?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have any problem letting it be passive. If they don't show up, that's really their own problem.
Representative Cogger?
I think I would, only because I think we need to be as directive as we can. And I think in this particular case, making the Lieutenant Governor work to find somebody that has the opposing view is more beneficial, in my view, than trying to give the Lieutenant Governor the latitude and then ending up in a court case because they may have favored or they could have called somebody else or the effort was not made properly according to one person's point of view. So I think the more directive you can be in this particular case, knowing the tension that can arise in some initiatives, although you're talking about the less contentious one, the more contentious one could create some real problems there.
Representative Holmes?
Mr. Chairman, I'm sympathetic to that. I would actually like to consider putting adding the words at least before one supporter and one opponent, because as it reads right now, it says it shall include the testimony of one supporter and one opponent, and if we said at least one supporter and one opponent, then it would say that obviously more than one person could talk if the Lieutenant Governor, and I assume a lot of these are going to have open testimony and more than one person is going to show up and speak. Is that, would that be acceptable?
Mr. Chairman, it's my understanding that in the election pamphlet, the practice, and the Lieutenant Governor's office obviously can speak to this, is that it basically boils down to one statement that the opponents or supporters get together and end up with one statement that goes in the pamphlet. And one thing that I do not want this language to allow is to have a gymnasium with 500 people in it spending time and time testifying on what they think about the initiative. What I want to do is have the information flow from the Lieutenant Governor's office, from the impartial Lieutenant Governor's office, for the information to flow out, not necessarily to have an 8-hour meeting in the gymnasium and have 500 people talk about what they think is in the initiative. So I want to make sure that's clearly on the record. Personally, I like the language the way it is. I'm not on the Judiciary Committee for a reason. I appreciate the input from Chairman.
Just a different question, but on the same section. Jason, can you tell me about the word or more? Whether two words or more. It says Lieutenant Governor shall hold. We had narrowed it to two meetings, which was quite specific. And I have a little bit of a concern about what the word or the words or more may mean for somebody who wishes to contest the process. Two was in the interest of the prime sponsor being specific. Do we want to say or more public hearings? Does that help or hinder this section? Because sometimes it's the drafter that does this and it doesn't express the wishes of the Lieutenant Governor's office or the prime sponsor. So, and I'll defer to what you think, but that or more concerns me.
I'll give it a shot, Mr. Chairman. It would be our intention to hold two per judicial district so that we can absorb the costs of this in our current budget. And I'm not sure if two or more, I think that still includes two. I'm not qualified to answer that.
We have Jan DeYoung with the Department of Law. Let's get the point of view of the prime sponsor and
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think following in the lines of the rules chair, if we're as specific and definitive as possible, it gives less wiggle room for those to interpret the actions of the lieutenant governor. And I'd be comfortable with specifically two meetings. That, for me, that's fine. That pushes it out to the entire state to have a conversation.
Okay, so we're clear. I'll offer a conceptual amendment to delete the words "or more." Is that correct? Is that closer to your wishes, is what I'm asking?
I would be acceptable to that amendment.
Representative Cockett?
Cause for pause. I will generally agree on the specific, but in the 4th Judicial District, you can be in Barrow, Chalkeetic, or Barrow, Bethel, or Fairbanks. And so I think that you may want to have four meetings. And so, I, you know, in the Judicial District of Anchorage, you're going to have a whole lot less of a problem having two. But in this one that encompasses almost a third of the state, and you can go all the way from the extreme northeast all the way down to the southwest in that same district.
And then I'll pose this back to the prime sponsor as well as the sponsoring amendment, which is, what if you only offer two meetings in that judicial district? Are you then inviting somebody who says you didn't travel the district and you didn't fulfill your obligation of
or more,
which is the sticky part of
That's a good point.
So you don't want to invite a litigation into the fact that you didn't fulfill a very nebulous component of the bless you of the of the section. So that's why I pose it as a question to both the lieutenant governor and the prime sponsor and the maker of the amendment, whether we're helping or hurting the intent of the sponsor, which is to provide specificity. Maybe we could go to every district. I'm just joking.
An amendment, Mr. Chairman?
So what thoughts about or more, or would you rather have us ask or pose a question to Jan Dillett Young with the Department of Law?
Mr. Chairman, the point about the size of the judicial districts, I think, is valid. But again, the point that I want, I guess the intent that I want to have is spreading out public hearings across the state. And if we have two in each judicial district, That's fine with me, I think. We have teleconference capabilities. If we have one in Bethel, the word spreads. There's a big meeting in Bethel on initiatives. People can call in. It's a delicate balance on what we're doing here, but I think if we say two and give latitude to the Lieutenant Governor's office, I think that's fine. I'd like to have 10 or more, personally, but I don't think that's doable. So.
On that point,
different.
A different point. So, Jan DeYoung, very quickly, because we've been at this all day on various things. Jan, can you introduce yourself and then tell us if you think the word "or more" could get us into trouble? Should it stay in or out?
Okay, this is Jan DeYoung. I was participating here for questions concerning the APOC provisions. I don't know if Mr. Barnhill is present there for the Lieutenant Governor's office. If he's not, I'd be happy to speak, but I think Mr. Barnhill might be preferred on this question if he's available.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ms. DeYoung. Mr. Barnhill is here. Jason, you got relief, dude.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mike Barnhill, Assistant Attorney General, Department of Law. In my view, the phrase two or more is synonymous with the phrase at least two. You can do it either way. Holding only two meetings satisfies the requirement.
Okay. All right, so then we'll just leave it in. So you have a question with regard to this amendment, Representative Holmes?
Yeah, well, it's kind of going back to my earlier concern, Mr. Chairman. I'm just worried that when you get into contentious initiatives, I'm flipping now. I'm going from the super friendly ones. Now my thought process on the super contentious ones. And you've got somebody who's trying to kill an initiative, and they just don't show up for the meeting. and they get all their supporters to just stay away, is that one more loophole for now making people go out and hold more meetings and dragging things? And what happens if the lieutenant governor, what are the consequences under this amendment if the lieutenant governor doesn't hold the meetings, or he holds the meetings but it's questionable whether or not they comply with the statute? What would be the consequence? Would there be a consequence to the amendment? Would there be a consequence to the lieutenant governor's office? What happens if this isn't complied with?
Mr. Chairman, we've all taken part in public meetings on issues, and if we could hold a public hearing on an issue and we can keep everybody who's passionate about it away, I'd be very surprised. And the language says one supporter. I seriously don't think that is an issue. I think that's an extreme example. The other part of your comment or question about the lieutenant governor, I think that is at the lieutenant governor's peril if he does not take part in this process. If the lieutenant governor refuses to hold hearings on an initiative that is in statute, I would think that would be probably a pretty difficult choice for an elected official in the state to make that action.
And Mr. Chairman, my concern is not so much a lieutenant governor is just going to decide he or she doesn't want to hold them. I know that's possible. But my concern is more if we were to have a meeting, if it were somehow determined that the meetings that were held did not comply with the law, that they were not valid meetings for whatever reason, either because they didn't include people from both sides or some other something under this, what happens? Is there any... Does the initiative get thrown out? Is there any effect on the actual initiative? What I don't want, Mr. Chairman, is to create some sort of back loop way to all of a sudden the initiative, and sometimes we like them and sometimes we hate them, but I don't want to create any sort of way, Mr. Chairman, that somebody could do a backdoor way to get an initiative thrown off the ballot or invalidated simply because the requirements of this weren't accurately complied with.
Mr. Chairman, I share your point of view. In no way is this intended to stop the initiative in any way whatsoever. I'm no attorney. I'm sure Mr. Barnhill can probably comment on that. But if this doesn't happen, then I think simply the lieutenant governor would be not following the law, and he would have to live with that. And I don't have any intent for it to affect the initiative whatsoever.
If I could direct this to Mr. Barnhill, on line 7, could we insert conceptually shall include the written or public testimony, and that way if one side doesn't show up but they submit a letter and we satisfy the testimony on one side, would that be a way to not risk invalidating the process, to at least have a letter there and to make available everything between a letter and a telephone and a person and somebody with a sign? Do you think that would be acceptable, Mr. Barnhill, as a conceptual amendment, and acceptable to the maker of the amendment, and acceptable to the prime sponsor?
Mr. Chair, I can't comment on whether it's going to be acceptable, but I think it's a fine concept.
Okay.
And it certainly clarifies the type of testimony that's permissible. And in answer to Representative Holmes's question through the chair, the court system, as a default position, likes to provide as much access to the ballot as possible. So I think technical defects in the public hearing process would likely be overlooked by the court in order to secure access by the initiative sponsors to the ballot.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So I'm going to assume that that's okay with you to create a minimum standard of satisfying the public meeting standard. Is that good?
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Okay. And it's okay with the maker of the amendment?
Written or
oral? It would say shall include the written or public.
Good. Oral. Written or oral.
Okay. Written or oral. Okay. Written or oral testimony of, so I will offer that as a conceptual amendment to the amendment. And Chris Ellingson is with us from APOC. She sent us a note that she would like to testify if public testimony is still open, because she's with APOC, and I think it will be germane Chris, do you want to speak to Amendment Number 4, or do you want to make some broader comments before we pass the bill out?
Through the chair, I am just online for any questions you may have for the APOC part of the bill.
Okay, we appreciate that. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Okay, so Susan, I'm going to offer a conceptual amendment to Amendment Number 4 on line 7 that will read, shall include the written or oral. And then the remainder of the line will read testimony of one supporter and one opponent of the initiative. Is there an objection to the conceptual amendment to Amendment Number 4? Seeing no objection, we have Amendment 4 before. So are there any other concerns with Amendment Number 4? Representative Grunberg?
And I'm sure, and I guess maybe this is for Mr. Hooley on behalf of Lieutenant Governor. It's not really a legal question. And I would just like it clarified. When you talk about the testimony of a supporter and an opponent, I assume you would, to line those people up, go to the sponsors and the leading people against it, so they would have a hand in who's selected. Is that correct?
Yes, sir, through the chair. We would start with the sponsors. We would start with the sponsors.
Okay, thank you. That's on the record. I'm satisfied.
Okay. All right, so is the objection to number amendment number 4?
Oh, I thought I had maintained. Already removed it. I already had. I do again.
Okay, so the objection to amendment number 4 is removed. Amendment number 4 passes. I'm going to move amendment number 5, which is E.9. Representative Holmes objects for the purposes of discussion. Amendment number 5 is the best that we thought we could do with drafting to try and address narrowing the discussion to a single subject and then to give the Lieutenant Governor maximum latitude in how many threads of the single subject can be brought up at one time. Is that a fair way to explain it, Jane? And as was discussed before in testimony, my concern with the cruise ship as an initiative is that there were perhaps 5 or 6 potential initiatives that were embedded inside of the cruise ship initiative. And there is a great deal of body of law, not only in the state of Alaska, but across the country that narrows the ability of a lieutenant governor's office or whomever to narrow to my satisfaction, the issue to a single subject. Is this amendment acceptable to the sponsor?
Mr. Chairman, I don't think I would object to the amendment. I believe it's probably covered in the Constitution language where the initiatives are shadowed on Article 2, Section 13, under form of bills, which lays out the single subject rule. But if I guess if you want to restate it, that's fine with me.
And we thought the same thing, that perhaps it gave a little more latitude to the Lieutenant Governor in defining subject matter. Is the objection maintained?
No, I'll remove my objection.
So the objection is withdrawn. Amendment number 5 passes. And amendment number 6 will be E.6, offered by Representative Grunberg. Representative Grunberg?
E6.
Yes. Do you have it?
No, I need it.
Oh.
Where is it?
Did everybody have a copy?
I do.
It's E.6.
Yeah.
You'll move the amendment, please.
And that would be amendment number 6.
Number 6.
Yes, I move the amendment. It simply makes the language a little
E.6, Susan, and do I have an objection to the amendment?
I'll object.
Representative Dahlstrom objects for purpose of discussion.
Yeah. If your members just look at the applicability section, it just reads a little clearer, I think. Same
Okay, you got me, Representative Grunberg. I have a hard time defining the difference between deleted material and the new material.
I think it's just written a little clearer.
Mr. Chairman, I have no objection to the amendment.
Okay. Is the objection maintained, Representative Dahlstrom?
No, I'll remove it.
Objection is removed. Amendment number 6 is adopted. Are there any other amendments? I will remind members that we have available for questions not only Mr. Barnhill, but Chris Ellingson from APOC and Jan DeYoung with the Department of Law. Is there a discussion on House Bill 36? Any discussion from the members? Chair would entertain. Representative Holmes?
Mr. Chairman, I've been struggling with this bill. I know a lot of people on this committee have struggled with this bill, and I know we've made a lot of changes to it. And we've spent a lot of time on what I sort of think of as the second half of the bill. We haven't spent a whole lot of time talking about the front part of the bill that talks about the money, talks about the disclosure sections, and I'm still don't have my head around them and comfortable, so I'm probably going to object to the bill for that reason.
All right, the chair would entertain.
What'd you say?
She said that she will object to the bill because of the front half, likely meaning Section 1. Is that a good interpretation of your remarks?
Mainly, Mr. Chairman, yes.
Representative Lynn?
So are we ready to move the bill?
Representative Dahlstrom is this close to making a motion.
I have a couple comments.
This would be the appropriate time to make a comment.
Thank you. Well, I do support the express intent as well as the sponsor. I appreciate your hard work on this. You first came to me about this during the last session, and I also support the initiative process. I'm, it's a balance between the public and the legislature, I think, but I've got to tell you, I have some serious problems tinkering with the initiative process, because I think it presents kind of a chilling effect, on the ability of folks to make, to put forth initiatives, in addition to the chilling effect we had on a bill on the same subject we had 2-3 years ago, which I voted against, by the way. And I do like some of the disclosure provisions, and I think the amendments have improved the bill. My concern is only 6 or 7, depending who's been here on the committee, has heard this very important bill, and I will probably vote to move it out of committee, because I think it's so serious that it does deserve a wider audience. But if it makes it to the House floor, all bets are off.
And my remarks, I've told the sponsors, I don't like this bill. I think I question whether Section 1 is constitutional. Because it's an idea. And I don't know that you can limit ideas. I'm not sure at what time you can do that. I certainly understand the difference between a candidate and an idea, and I certainly understand the difference once something is become a certified ballot initiative. So I do not like the bill. I'm going to do not pass on the bill, but I also will move it from committee because I feel strongly that that is generally speaking, the way that I like to conduct my committee for ideas, as Representative Lynn said, to move to other committees and to be heard by a broader cross section. I am in favor of limiting funds once a ballot initiative has been certified, but the Supreme Court seems to feel otherwise than me, so I find myself contrary to the Supreme Court of the United States on that portion of the bill, where I think money too much influences an idea at the ballot box, where you have as much money that was spent on vote no on Measure 4, which I was a no and bought advertising personally, no, but I didn't spend more than $500, which is the limit that I was allowed to give to any particular candidate. And I'm troubled that a corporation, even a cruise ship company, can influence a ballot box by writing a large check. And so in my own industry that I draw my private sector income from, I share the same concerns that a corporation can become a greater influence in the public forum than an individual, and that makes me uncomfortable. Insofar as when an idea is moving through the pipeline to enjoy the benefits of direct democracy, and I am an advocate of a direct democracy, even though my industry has been punished greatly by direct democracy, I think that it violates the First Amendment to put limits of disclosure on that, and I have been told by my friends Eric Croft, former Representative Eric Croft, and Representative Crawford, that there were members of the oil and gas industry that wanted to donate money to the reserves tax, and had their names been disclosed, they would not have been able to be an advocate for that idea during the phase where the idea is out there and has to gather signatures. So I find myself fundamentally opposed to the premise for the bill. But I don't know that, that that's the purpose of doing committee work. It certainly is not for me to put bills in the drawer. That's not something that we have a custom of doing in this committee. I do have the courage of my convictions to vote up or down for something. And in this case, I will be a do not pass on this bill, but I will vote to move it from committee so that I don't keep this bill from advancing. Those are my remarks, Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had intended to raise one other issue, and I just noticed it as I was going through the bill.
Sure.
I would like to, with the permission of the bill sponsor, narrow the title so it's not as broad as it is, because this is a very broad thing, and we could see it come back the last minutes of the session. Who knows what would have. And so I'm going to offer a conceptual amendment to narrow the title of the bill to the subjects in it.
Susan, this would be a conceptual amendment number 7.
Yes, sir.
Representative Grunberg?
That's it.
Are you going to offer what the title?
That's the amendment I offer. Oh, I see. Okay. The amendment is to narrow the title to the subjects that are in the bill. And the bill drafters can do that.
Boy, I got to tell you, as the chair, I can't.
I'll object, Mr. Chair.
All right, Representative Coghill objects. You're going to have to help me a little bit more than that, Representative Grunberg.
Mr. Chairman, I don't disagree with the maker of the amendment, generally speaking. However, as long as it's in the possession of the House, we can put a title amendment on it.
Mm-hmm.
So this has this in the floor to go through yet, and as you can see, it's not. It's not going to be zipping through. So I would, rather than having a conceptual amendment, I would like to see a more exact amendment.
Well, I would then just kind of serve notice that if it's not narrowed by the time it gets to the floor, I'll offer such an amendment on the floor. I can't do it any more than that at the moment.
Would you like to withdraw the conceptual amendment then?
I don't see what the problem is in inviting the bill drafters to draft it narrowly.
Representative Johansson.
Mr. Chairman, I have zero intention of moving this to the floor in the last 3 days of session. This will be worked on next year in its next committee of referral, and I will guarantee you that we will work on a title amendment and work with your office as we have on so many bills in the past. You have my word.
But that's good enough for me. I'll withdraw the amendment.
Okay.
I just wanted to be sure it's done at some point.
Amendment number 7 is withdrawn. Any more remarks on the bill? The chair will entertain a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wish to move the sponsor substitute for House Bill number 36, version E, with attached amendments, attached zero fiscal note, and individual recommendations of committee members.
Thank you. Is there an objection?
I'll object.
Representative Holmes objects. Susan, will you take the roll, please?
Representative Grunberg?
No.
Representative Holmes?
No.
Representative Dahlstrom?
Yes.
Representative Coghill?
Yes.
Representative Gatto is not present. Representative Lynn?
Yes.
Representative Rammers?
Yes.
4 yes, 2 no.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members.
Okay, Representative Coghill, we're going to lose for a few minutes. Is that right?
I can go ahead and get started on this, because I have the floor scheduled for tomorrow. I have to.
We're going to move to.
Which we're all anxiously awaiting.
Yeah. So I'll sign this up.
All right. And we're going to move to Senate Bill 48, which is a bill that we've already seen here in House in the House Judiciary Committee. Members, Senate Bill 48 is word for word identical to House Bill 153 that we moved through this committee.
Was that your bill?
Oh, my. No.
It was the CRNA bill I carried through. Yeah. Remember, it's on the Road Service Act.
I think we're good on this one. As long as we have four people here.
Yeah, I'm here.
We have five.
Three, four. Okay.
If we move ahead, we don't have to start.
Who's presenting on this bill?
Ernest.
Something about being Ernest.
We're so happy to see you. Welcome. Could you just introduce yourself for the record and tell us a little bit about yourself, Ernest?
Jerry Springer.
All right. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Ernest Prox. I work for Senator Terrio.
Welcome.
I guess for those of you who don't know who I am, do you know who the Prox family is? That should speak well enough for itself.
Are you a Prox?
I am a Prox.
Hey, I like your family. They're wonderful. Great Fairbanks family, Prox family. Okay.
Mike is my dad.
Oh, excellent.
And we're known, if you've been in Fairbanks, we own Prospector Outfitters.
Great. You got a great dad. So, Ernest, if you want to take us through this, we have heard the identical version of this bill in this committee only last week or the week before, I think. And Renee Broeker is with us. She's the attorney for the Fairbanks North Star Borough, if any members have questions. Ernest?
Okay, yeah, as you said, Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 48 is the exact same thing as House Bill 153, which you heard, I think, last week or a week and a half ago. I'm assuming that you're familiar with the bill itself. I just kind of want to offer a little comment regarding some of the emails that we have received from our office on the bill. There is one particular service district within Senator Terrio's legislative area, and there's been some conflict between the commissioners and the residents of the service district. There's the accusations that there's not enough communication going on, that the commissioners are acting outside their authority and violating the provisions of the Open Meetings Act. And so their concern from the emails that we have received is, is this bill, are you doing this at the behest of the commissioners in order to give them more power and to jump through the loophole, so to speak? And that's not the intention of this bill. This was brought before us by the Fairbanks North Star Borough attorney and some of the people that they work with. And it doesn't, Senate Bill 48, it does not give them any means to jump through the loopholes. If the commissioners are violating the Open Meetings Act right now, they're going to be doing it in this bill. Regardless, and if those instances are occurring, that's something that needs to be resolved with the borough and the residents of themselves. They need to take it upon themselves to make sure that the commissioners are in fact doing what they're supposed to do. The two main sections of the bill, the first, where it allows municipal service area boards to meet to act on matters that are solely administrative and managerial, and also modifying the requirements for constituting a meeting. This may help reduce some of those conflicts. There seems to be a problem of lack of communication within the within the service districts over those kind of various issues, and those two provisions may in fact help resolve some of the problems that the service districts are experiencing. That's basically all I have.
Thank you. Are there any questions for us? Ernest, you're one of the hardest working people in this whole building, and I appreciate your work ethic. We appreciate you being here to present this bill. You did a fine job. Thank you. And I always like to see folks from our hometown, not only in the building, but here in our committee room. You did excellent, and we thank you. Are there any questions for Ernest? Are there any questions for Renee Broker, who has stayed late with Fairbanks North Star Borough? Renee, are you there?
Yes, I am.
How are you tonight?
I'm lovely, thank you.
Good. We thank you for sticking around this evening and helping us. We've heard this bill. It moved out of our House committee without incident, and I anticipate the same momentarily. Any remarks aren't necessary, but salutations are always welcome. Do you have anything you'd like to add, Renee?
No, it's a beautiful day in Fairbanks, but you heard me when we had the House version, and so I won't repeat myself.
Yes, ma'am. Always nice to hear from you. Ernest, any final remarks?
No, Mr. Chairman, I think that is it.
You did a great job. Thank you very much. The chair would entertain a motion. Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wish to move the CS for Senate Bill number 48, Version C, with attached to a physical note and individual committee recommendations.
All right. Without objection, SB 48 moves. Ernest, tell Senator Terrio that I'll carry this on the floor for him as his request. And they picked me up as a co-sponsor on it, and it'd be my pleasure. And we appreciate you coming forward. The committee did an excellent job, as usual. We appreciate it a lot. Thank you. All right, if we can go to Senate Bill 48, please. 148, I apologize. Oh, we are so happy to see you.
Thank you.
So introduce yourself for the record, please.
Okay, Dorothy Shockley, Senator Albert Kukesh's staff.
Could you reintroduce yourself?
Dorothy Shockley.
I'm so happy to see you. I wanted you to do it twice, Dorothy. So nice to see you.
Well, thank you so much for hearing Senate Bill 148.
You ready? Go ahead.
Okay. Senate Bill 148 will resolve the issue of liability to the state or employees of the state when partnering with federally recognized tribes under the Indian Reservation Roads Program. With decline in state and federal highway funds, it's imperative we collaborate and work together. This bill will assist the partnering process and ultimately benefit all Alaskans by leading to long-term improvements in the state overall's transportation infrastructure. As DOT prepares for the next step, the first time tribes can bring forth monies for matching funds and maintenance funds. And enclosed, we have a letter from the Commissioner of DOT, Manly Hot Springs Village Council, and Ruby Village Council. And I've also enclosed two lists from the 2008 IRR Road Funds Program. One is just simply a list of villages and the money that's been allocated, and the other list is a breakdown of inventory, how the miles that they have in their inventory and their population, and how the funds are calculated or formulated by that. And also a synopsis that the Department of Transportation prepared, and it just kind of gives you an overview of the program and the road inventory and how that funding happens. Use of IR funding by tribes, and it tells you they can use 25% of that for maintenance to match other federal funds, and design and construction. And they're also going to get probably approximately $35 million in stimulus. And that's about it. It's fairly simple.
Thank you.
And we appreciate your support.
Yes, ma'am. Are there questions for Dorothy? We do have Peter Pitts here with the AG's office, who would like to offer testimony. Are you here for questions, Peter? Or would you like to offer testimony? Okay, please come on forward. Thank you, Dorothy.
Hi, Peter Putz here with the State of Alaska Department of Law. This bill has received broad-based support from DOT and from the tribes, and the plaintiff's bar was consulted as well at the request of Senator French and Willikowski, and so it does receive broad-based support. There are just a couple provisions I wanted to put the intent on the record. The first is the standards. We added some language in response to concerns from the plaintiff's bar about, well, what standards will apply if tribes were to perform work on state roads. The answer is that standards will apply. Some of those are defined at 25 CFR Part 170, Subpart D, Appendix B, and certainly the state would require in any agreement that certain standards be met. But the plaintiff's bar nevertheless had a desire to specify by statute that if work is to be done, some baseline standards would be identified. And the question was, how can we sue if there aren't any identified standards? So the language we chose was applicable federal and state standards have to be met. And that isn't to suggest that in every case both state and federal standards would apply, or even that every conceivable standard needs to be listed. There should simply be a requirement or a reference that applicable standards be followed in when tribes do work on state roads. The second thing I would like to comment on is the last is the definition of independent negligence. That's at page 1, lines 12 to 14, and continues to the top of page 2. The intent there is, again, to define independent negligence, and we do so in this bill by defining certain actions that the state would not be liable for. So independent negligence does not include actions arising out of the state selection, supervision, administration, monitoring, or controlling of the activities of the tribe's agent, employees, or contractors. And independent negligence does not include actions based on or premised upon the state approving or accepting certain work. That's my testimony. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions for Peter? Peter, I don't see any questions from the committee. We thank you. We do have Mark O'Brien available from DOT for questions. Any questions for members from DOT? That concludes public testimony. We thank you very much, Dorothy. It was great to see you this evening. Any committee discussion on Senate Bill 148? Chair would entertain a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wish to move the House CS for the CS for Senate Bill number 148, version P, with attached to a fiscal note and individual recommendations.
Without objection, Senate Bill 148 moves from committee.
I was just thinking about any way I could give her a hard time.
Dorothy, thank you.
Can we take a timeout?
Take a breath at ease. 6:15. Before us is House Bill 181. We have Tabby and Representative Kawasaki. Pleasure to see both of you. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, for the record, Representative Scott Kawasaki, member of the House representing District 9 Fairbanks and the other counterpart Fairbanks District. I appreciate the indulgence of the committee to allow me to introduce House Bill 181.
The last bill of the session.
The best bill of the session?
That is selective listening. My friend. I said last bill of the session, but nicely done.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 181 addresses a key goal that the Alaska Highway Safety Office Strategic Highway Plan has put in place. Another one of those strategic plans has been traffic calming devices, which you're very aware of in the Fairbanks area. What this plan recommends is that all cars and trucks use headlights on during at all times. Research has shown that there's a decrease in traffic accidents, particularly head-on traffic accidents, when daytime running lights are used. The Alaska Highway Safety Office has determined that enforcement of a headlight law could decrease head-on collisions by 7% to 15%. The effectiveness of the headlight on laws has been seen in Alaska on the Seward Highway, for instance, where in the mid-90s Department of Transportation began installing signs on the highway and specifically requiring that headlights be used at all times during travel between Anchorage and Seward. The Department of Public Safety, Department of Transportation acknowledged the effectiveness of headlight usage with instructional signs in saving lives. According to the Department of Transportation, there was a marked decrease in the number of crashes along the Seward Highway during that time. Similar other polar region countries, like Sweden, have implemented headlight on laws, especially since, and the reason why is because the sunlight during the off times of summer, the sun lingers in, and it's a lot easier to see cars, oncoming traffic, when there's a sun behind you, when the lights are on, when rather than when they are not. If you're just driving down, say Egan Drive here to Fred Meyer on an evening or even a daytime, there's a large stretch, probably about 2.5 miles, right around there by the dump. And if you think about driving down during that time, whether it's broad daylight or night, you can see the car with the headlights on. You can see a car that's right next to it, and you won't even see it until it's right in front of you. So it's very practical in thought. Currently, 39 out of 50 states, including Alaska, require headlights for motorcycles at all times. We implemented the law, and I don't actually have a specific date, but Department of Transportation is here to speak to that, because for similar reasons, it's easier to see a motorcycle with its headlights on to avoid crashes and collisions. House Bill 181, I believe, will increase safety on Alaska's roadways by making all vehicles easier to see while traveling. In addition to both Department of Transportation supporting the bill, the Highway Safety Office supporting the bill, I know that recently I just saw, and this had nothing to do with this bill, but the National Insurance, some national insurance group has been putting on advertisements saying that you should drive with your lights on at all times. And even manufacturers of some vehicles have begun adding daytime running lights as a course of vehicle safety. With that, I will leave, I guess that's the end of my testimony, but I will leave Tabitha Williams here for any questions on the particulars of the bill. And I know that there is Mike Smith from the Alaska Highway Safety Office to make comments on the bill and answer any questions of a technical nature.
I have the obvious question. I was in the State Affairs with Representative Gruenberg. I think Representative Seaton was the chair. You were on the committee, and Senator Bundy tricked me into voting for primary seatbelt law, which I then got ticketed for, and I got a $25 ticket. And I told the state trooper I did not fall for the line of "Don't you know who I am?" But I did tell him I voted against that, which I did on the floor. And so the concern I have about this bill, and perhaps you can remedy it for me, Representative Kawasaki, is can you be stopped? Does this create probable cause for a law enforcement person to stop you because they think that your car should have headlights that are on, even if your car is a prior year that where it's not equipped to have automatic headlights?
The answer to that question, Mr. Chairman, is yes. This would become a primary offense. If this law passes and were enacted, highways, and there is a definition, technical definition for highway, which the Department of Transportation will talk about, it will mandate that you have lights on at all times.
So to follow up, so that means if I'm driving along, quiet enjoyment in my vehicle, I could get pulled over by law enforcement for not having my lights on because perhaps my vehicle wasn't equipped with that because it's an earlier made vehicle, and then the law enforcement would have effectively stopped me.
Through the chair, that is correct. It would be a primary offense of law where a police officer, law enforcement officer, could stop you.
So if I had remorse for the primary seatbelt law, then I probably will not like this one. Is that a fair conclusion to reach?
Let me just say something about the primary seatbelt law. And there is, I mean, it's a gray area on the primary seatbelt law. And I was probably juggling, I would have juggled with that concept as well. I think I spoke to you about this because Mothers Against Drunk Driving was advocating for the bill at the time. When you wear a seatbelt in a car, it probably does help so that if you if your tires start to spin, you wave back and forth, you probably will be situated in your seat and not cause injury quite as often. That's advocating for it. The other thing is, but the other flip side of that, I guess, would be, Mr. Chairman, that if you're not wearing a seatbelt and you run off the road and you hit a tree and you hurt yourself, you're only hurting yourself. This law, though, applies for the other person, the person that's driving oncoming to you, that they'll be able to see you better and that you'll be able to see them better. And I think that's the real distinction in a primary seatbelt law versus a primary headlight law, is that this is to protect folks that have difficulty seeing. And AARP isn't quite with us on it, but I know that there are several members of AARP who have spoken in favor of this, and I think it's in the packet right now as added testimony in support, that as your eyes start to fail, it sure helps to be able to see oncoming traffic. And so I think that would be my comment to that.
Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kawasaki, on the fiscal note, it refers to 39 signs being posted, and I think that's an obvious that we would have to post the signs, but how do we come up with a number 39? Is there a formula that DOT uses for, you know, number of miles per sign? Or
Through the chair, Representative Dahlstrom, there actually is some sort of a formula, and actually we don't know that. There is a person from Department of Transportation who could speak more to that. I think the idea would be entry points of ports. So if you come off the Juneau port, there's a sign there that reminds you you have to drive with your headlights on. Entering the Alaska Highway, there'd probably be a sign there. Basically, entering and exiting most ports is where I think that they had intended to apply the signs. And so that's where that number comes from. I think it's probably, if you want more signs, we can say more signs. If you want less signs, we can say less signs. But I think that was the bare minimum where the department felt comfortable applying signs.
Representative Lynn.
Thank you. As I read it, it just says you have to keep your headlights on. So it can be either automatic or you just reach down and turn on the switch, right? So you have an obligation to turn on the switch unless it's automatic.
Through the chair, Representative Lynn, that's correct. A lot of cars nowadays do have daytime running lights, or they're lights that automatically turn on when the vehicle turns on. The idea for folks that don't have the automatic lights will have to turn them on. And I do it as a course of safety for me. And I know that a lot of other people have done that. I think it would be, if the state were to adopt a primary law, that it would be a fairly easy concept for most folks to understand.
Thank you.
Representative Kawasaki, do you have any language developed to make it a secondary, what is that called, a secondary offense, you know, where you can't get stopped for it? That's the part on it.
I don't understand the problem there. Either they're on or they're off, Mr. Chair. I mean, the problem cause would be not seeing headlights. I'm sorry. The problem cause would be not seeing headlights, right? It's not like a seatbelt where it's arguably difficult to see somebody's wearing one or not, unless you're driving right next to them, maybe looking down into their car. But a headlight, I guess from the rear it's hard to tell, but from the front it's certainly easy to tell.
Representative Cargill?
Not to get into the middle of that one, but ask the sponsor. Personally, I like this idea, and I know that most of your cars nowadays are manufactured with the lights on with the ignition. Unfortunately, I have a couple of old cars, and I have killed the battery I don't know how many times. So I like the idea of driving with lights on. Is there anything in here that we could do that would be more carrots than sticks? Have you thought along the line of whatever incentive it is to get... Because I know you can buy devices, I think, that can be placed in automobiles so that when you turn your ignition on, the lights automatically go on when you turn the ignition off. To me, that would be the better than starting to make offenses to drive people to it rather than an incentive to lead people to it. So had you given that any thought?
Through the chair, Representative Cockula, I think that education is always, I think, the first... cheapest, best route to compliance. And My dad drove with his lights on when we were on highways, and my mom did after she got in a wreck and ran into another vehicle. She decided that that was probably safer that folks saw her on the streets. I guess we could do something like that, and I guess that even if it weren't made into a law, that as course, where we've seen it proven time and time again, for instance, on head-on collisions in the Seward Highway corridor, that signs do help, and that people, when they see other people with their headlights on, sometimes they do the same thing. And I think that education is definitely not that I would support that sort of a concept,
Chairman,
as well.
And my thinking was, because here's what happens. I drive my wife's really nice Buick. Lights come on, I'm happy, I just go. Then I get in my old rickety old truck, and I just take off driving. And all of a sudden, I'm going to have a policeman stop me when I'm on way to doing some business. I'm going to be guilty of a primary offense because I live in this kind of differing world. So I will tell you, it would certainly be an incentive after I get stopped once or twice to go find some kind of device. You know, I understand that. But I would much rather not put so much pressure on people because I think it would become a nuisance that doesn't outweigh the benefit. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so that's... And I have a whole bunch of amendments for this bill, by the way.
Representative Grimberg.
I think that we are seeing a number of ads coming out, everything from buckle up to don't use your DVDs when you're on there. And I would think at some point, maybe the Department of Public Safety, and I see Ms. Stancliffe here, that we should have some kind of an appropriation or some legislation that encourages the department to do a comprehensive PR campaign for all these safety things. But I think we could have a very simple motto: turn it on, turn them on.
Mr.
Turn them on.
Chairman, Representative Grunberg. Quite the wordsmith.
Every moment of his life.
Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I was, I'm going to have to run back and talk about fish. But I'm going to leave you.
You have to do what?
Talk about
fish. Oh, well, we can just hold this over until next year because I've got a whole bunch of amendments.
Yes.
But I would like to introduce my staff assistant.
You have a bill up in resources?
No, we've got confirmations. I'll stay if you'd like me to, Mr. Chairman.
Fish Wars.
Right. Fish Wars. But right.
What I'd like to do, Mr.
Representative Coghill,
just before he leaves, I'd like to tell him why I think I need to amend it. We have people who actually have more endangerment of the public by the placement of driving lights that are very, very bright.
Oh, yeah.
And we have the misalignment of headlights in my neck of the woods all the time, which is, mm-hmm. if you want to talk about public safety. And then we have manufacturers selling these really bright blue lights that to me are very blinding, especially when you get into icy road areas. And I think if we're going to talk public safety, that far outweighs the headlights on all day long issue. And so I am going to be drafting some amendments to bring these issues to light.
My issue would be a secondary offense. Offering probable cause and a primary offense is a great concern to me.
Mr. Chair, on that, I think it would be really difficult to make this a secondary offense.
Well, I sure don't like primary offenses, I got to tell you.
Mr. Chairman, my staff person actually has a great story to talk about. Primary offense being pulled over. She didn't tell me how much she hated this bill until after I had already assigned it to her. But she has a ticket in limbo right now, and maybe she'll address that in terms of primary offense versus secondary offense.
Sorry, Representative Kawasaki. Good luck. Yes, Representative Coghill.
I guess we can't wait to hear her story, but I'm serious about the bright lights issue.
I thought you were, okay. With you. Tabby, very quickly, and then we have Kurt Smith here, and it appears we're going to hold this bill over as the last bill of the session. Tabby, and then Mr. Smith. Welcome. Do you have anything to add, Tabby, or did we just kind of leave you in alert? You don't need to tell us your story about primary. If you don't want to, you don't have to. That's not...
I like the secondary fence thing. That would be good.
She likes the secondary fence.
Just introduce yourself just for the record, though, if you're going to...
I'm Tabitha Williams. Staff. Intern.
So you're so welcome here. We're happy to have yours. So just relax. You're in favor of it being a secondary fence. Is that correct?
I personally am. We won't tell your boss.
Keep it on the record.
Will we, Max or Lindsay? Yeah,
Would you like to have Mr. Smith come up? Okay, Mr. Smith, would you join us, please? Mr. Smith, welcome. We're so happy to have you before us for the very last bill of the first half of the 26th session. So as concise as you want to be, it would be appreciated by everybody at this table.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kurt Smith, State Traffic and Safety Engineer for the DOTTL.
Mr. Smith, if you could point the
microphone. Welcome, sir. It's nice to see you. Thank you for joining us so late in the evening.
DOTPF strongly supports this bill. It's a cost-effective way to save lives by making vehicles more conspicuous. We estimate it will reduce head-on and other collisions by around 10% and save a minimum of one life per year, as well as eliminating many non-fatal crashes. Signs will be needed at major points of entry into the state, airports, borders, marine terminals, etc., to notify drivers that Alaska law requires them to turn their lights on. We estimate about 40 signs will be needed at a cost of around $135,000. And the department has identified 40,000 of safety funding we can apply to the signs, leaving a fiscal note of about 95,000. Before this law becomes effective, the Highway Safety Office will fund an education campaign informing the public about it. And those are my comments.
Thank you very much, Kurt. Representative Krumer?
Thank you. And thank you for being so much on point. I really appreciate that.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Clearly, we're going to hold this bill over. We thank you very much, Mr. Smith, for your testimony. Tabby, we appreciate you for your candor and for your testimony. Chris has been doing sound for us most of the year. Chris, we want to thank you. I didn't catch your last name, but I would thank you. What is it? Bannon. Bannon, thank you. Thank you very much. Representative Holmes?
Before we wrap up on the bill, could I make a quick comment heading into interim on the House Bill 181? I just wanted to say that I know we'll be working on it over the interim, but I really like the idea. And the reason is, as a kid, I used to drive back and forth on the Seward Highway a lot. It's a two-lane highway. Now they've added some nice new passing lanes, but when I was a kid, there weren't any passing lanes. We have a lot of roads, a lot of highways in the state that are two lanes with no passing lanes. And especially in the summer when you get the RVs and other slow vehicles, people pull out to pass, and I can't tell you the number of days that I pulled out thinking that road was clear and saw that it was a gray day and there was a gray car or a white car heading my way that I just didn't see. So, you know, I think that there are some real safety concerns, and if there are other primary versus secondary or other things that we need to work out in the interim, and I also agree with the Representative Coghill's comments about those super bright lights being potentially dangerous, but I would urge everyone to keep an open mind over the interim.
I would, and on that point, I will suggest that this is regressive legislation and that it... it is discriminatory toward those people that don't drive new cars, and that it makes them more of a target for law enforcement, it makes them more of a target for dead batteries, it makes them more of a target to be a stranded driver, and that it discriminates against a socioeconomic group that can't necessarily afford a new car or chooses not to drive one, and it makes them subject to probable cause stops and other things that encroach on our liberties, and we have to balance that against safety. And whether that's the best place for us to spend the next $100,000 of ever diminishing Department of Transportation dollars on signage for that when there are many ways to spend $100,000 in signs to save lives. So it is appropriate that we stop on a complex issue, which is many of the issues that we have taken on. I want to thank Susan Ryle for just doing a splendid job. And we may have another meeting if anything on the calendar calls for it. Tabby, thank you very much for coming before the committee. You did a great job. We may have another meeting if anything on the calendar calls for the judiciary meeting to convene, but Jane told me otherwise. Our calendar is clear. Is that right, Jane? And then, of course, I want to thank not only members and folks on staff that have helped us, but Jane Pearson, rock star, super rock star. Yay, super rock star. And then Karen Lidster, I want to make sure that you got that last remark on your computer, your ever-dandy computer. So one day you didn't bring it.
I will remember it.
Yeah, but you can add that as an addendum. I want to thank the members for a lively debate, for a lot of patience on a lot of charged issues, and for a lot of consideration for those with whom around this table or at that witness stand or in the audience with whom we did not agree on issue. And I thought we exhibited not only a good work ethic, despite the Conservatives for Palin website, which has suggested otherwise, that we distributed, we showed an excellent work ethic, a great deal of tolerance, a great deal of professionalism, and a high degree of productivity, as well as discretion in which bills and in which condition those bills should leave this committee, generally speaking, Representative Gruenberg. And
Mr. Chair, I'd like to thank you for being Jay Rammers.
I have all day long, Representative Lynn. It's a burden. It's a burden, I got to tell you.
What do you always say, Bing?
Yeah, Bing, yeah. So anyway, as we wind things up, any final remarks by any members?
We don't have any Senate bills in the committee.
President Gruenberg, I don't think we have any.
Not a Senate bills.
I think we have exhausted a very lean year for productivity.
I'll say that.
Just stay tuned.
Yeah.
There are more days to come.
Yes. Maybe there will be. Any other final remarks? I want to thank everybody, particularly Vice Chair Dahlstrom. It's always a pleasure to work with you. And the minority members, you're amazing, and you never cease to challenge me, Representative Gruenberg, in every way. But I love you like an uncle. You can determine whether you live in the cellar or whether you live upstairs with the rest of the family. God bless you.
On behalf of Harry Potter and the crew, I thank you. Well,
Representative Lynn, Representative Coghill, and our friend Representative Gatto, we thank all of you, and it's been a pleasure. And with that, at 6:40, we are adjourned.
Want to take one of those for the interim?